Today I'm going to I'm going to offer some reflections on the nature of Mara, which is the Buddhist equivalent of the devil, Satan. And this is a language that in some ways is less direct. It speaks mythically, symbolically, through figures, through a personified figure called Mara. And Mara, literally, means something like death. Perhaps we could translate it as the killer, that which kills. And Mara is in fact seen as synonymous with the figure of Yama in Indian mythology, Yama being the lord of death. And we saw yesterday in the guided meditation, which was a reflection in this sense on Mara, on death, that we have as human beings a tendency towards complacency. We don't notice very often or very clearly how precarious and uncertain our existence is. Instead, we persist in doing all the things we have to do, many of them, of course, being entirely worthwhile, but only rarely, perhaps when a relative or a loved one, a friend, suddenly dies, are we shocked into an awareness of the transiency, the unreliability, the uncertainty of our existence. There's an image used by the 8th century Indian monk Shantideva. He says we're like cattle sitting in a field or standing in a field, each of us happily chomping away on the grass, unaware that the butcher is coming into the field every day and leading one of us away. And what do we do? Chomp, 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 chomp. We might glance up and see someone coming into the field. We might realize there's one cow less the next day. But still, we just keep going, chomp, chomp, chomp. There are many passages in the early Buddhist literature, in the Pali Canon, in which we find dialogues between the Buddha and Mara. Mara comes down, as it were, from wherever Mara lives, and appears on the scene, and comes up to the Buddha, and usually says something rather seductive. There's one exchange in which Mara says to the Buddha, "Life is long. You should live like a milk-sucking baby." And the Buddha replies, "Life is short. You should live as though your head was on fire." Now, in the language of these dialogues, we move away from what is sometimes a rather dry, maybe rather a rational language, like we looked at yesterday, these different perception and feeling, all this stuff, And all of a sudden we find ourselves in some ways, much more richer, the more imaginative language of myth, of symbol, of poetry, of imagery. And there's an awful lot captured in the phrase, live like a milk-sucking baby. It's as though when under the influence of that very powerful voice, and again, I'm not suggesting that it's something that literally some demonic figure comes down, invades our minds and gives us this little bit of advice, but it's rather a way of talking about certain deeply seated assumptions and longings and desires and perceptions. Live like a milk-sucking baby. Just keep tugging away at the teat, satiating yourself like a little baby, which is an image of somehow our existence often being rather infantile, rather childish, rather dependent, rather clutching, holding on, just constantly drawing nourishment, sustenance, impervious to everything else that's going on around us. We somehow want to be held and cuddled and rocked, and we think that life is something that does that for us. Sometimes it does. But to what extent is this also somehow a frame of mind in which we allow ourselves to rest in a kind of a deep complacency, a kind of blindness in a way, and we keep, like the cattle chomp on the field, the baby sucks on the teat, and yet we're not really present, therefore, to the condition that we are in fact in. And so the Buddha, which again doesn't have to mean, you know, the historical person, Siddhartha Gautama, but refers really to that more awake and conscious and present part of ourselves, periodically reminds us, life is short. Live as though your head were on fire. In other words, your condition is one that is constantly being consumed, burnt up. There's the image of pain, there's the image of something being sort of worn away, moment by moment, getting burnt up. Notice that. And of course that in some respects is what we do when we sit and we walk. Once we've stabilized our mind on our breath, on our sensations, we pay attention to the transience of things, the shifting nature of things, the endless entropy in which we live, each breath being one less, this running down, looking at yourself in the mirror and noticing more wrinkles around the eyes, a gradual aging and fading, a loss of our powers, our physical powers, our mental powers. And pay attention to that. It's somehow important, because by not noticing this, we somehow fail to engage, fail to live fully. Our life is often somehow constantly being deferred or delayed. When I retire, when I've got some time, next year, then I'll go and study and meditate and devote myself to philosophy. And yet that seems often to be endlessly put off. In the same way with death. I've noticed with elderly people that there's still, however old you get, the sense that there's always going to be at least a year or two to go. There's always this kind of comforting buffer zone. You know, you feel it when you're young that you're not, yeah, sure, I'm going to die, but it won't be next week, it won't be next year, it'll be some time off. But as you get older, there may be more and more moments in which you realize the precariousness of things, but for much of the time you still keep on with that same buffer zone ahead of you, that comfort zone, which somehow obscures or prevents you from really touching the flow of life itself. And as we saw yesterday, death is not something we dwell upon in order to feel gloomy and miserable. When we incorporate or integrate an awareness of mortality, paradoxically, we become that much more sensitized, that much more alert to the fact that we are alive. That life, when seen from the perspective of death, is intensified, it's enriched. The beauty, the mystery, the ineffability of existence strikes us more deeply. We may be moved in those moments more to poetry than to gossip. There's something deeply moving in the sheer fact of life itself, but we tend not to notice it. We tend to prefer dispersal and distraction and forgetting. So Mara, although in some cases is a way of talking about physical death, Mara in most instances is a way of talking about a kind of inner death, a spiritual death, a death within us, inside ourselves. We might call it nowadays boredom. I mean, this comes very much from the writings of a Baudelaire. I don't know whether you have read Les Fleurs du Mal, the Flowers of Evil, but for Baudelaire, writing in the middle of the 19th century, the secular contemporary version of the devil is what he calls l'ennui, boredom. In other words, this sense that nothing is really terribly interesting, that when we're left to our own devices, we feel somehow at a loss, fidgety, restless, grasping for this and that, for some kind of stimulation. So the devil, or Mara, is not some sort of powerful force, but rather the devil, Mara, is that which kind of shuts us down, obstructs us, blocks us. And in fact, in the I think in Hebrew, the word Satan, or however you pronounce it, Satan, I think it means something like the opponent, the adversary, that which stands against you. The word in Greek, diabolos, where we get our diabolic, diabolos means that which is thrown across your path.
Your path.
Oh, good, even better. Defers you from your path. Cuts across your path. Now that, I think, is a very, very crucial image. Because if we remember what the Buddha is teaching, as are most traditions of religion and spirituality, they're teaching us a path. A path is a process of movement towards the realization of our values, what we hold most dear, how we wish our life to achieve fulfillment. And yet there is this counter movement which somehow blocks the path, which somehow gets in our way. That's very much the nature of Mara. Of course, death, physical death, very much gets in our way. If we are seeking to achieve anything in life, if we drop dead, that's the most effective way of not achieving it, obviously. But it's not only physical death that gets in our way or defers us from our path, but also what in Buddhism are called the hindrances. There's an awful lot in all Buddhist traditions about obstacles, hindrances. But we have to ask, but what is it that they hinder? What is it that they block? They block the free flow of pursuing, of walking a path. So you have the five hindrances in early Buddhism. Attachments, aversions, restlessness, lethargy, doubt. And you might have experienced this yourselves, that when you're sitting in meditation, you're trying to cultivate mindfulness, attention, concentration, awareness, whatever you call it. There are periods in the meditation when you enter into the flow of those things. Even though you're sitting still, I think when we say to ourselves at the end of a sitting, that was a good one, that was a great meditation I just had, what do we mean? I think at some level we mean that in that experience we somehow felt ourselves unblocked. We somehow felt that we had entered into a flow. And again, this is another metaphor the Buddha uses a great deal, the idea of entering the stream. This is what the path begins with, entering into it, and the path itself is compared to a stream. I mean, some of you might have associations here with Taoism. The Tao is like water. And remember, the word Tao simply means the path. It doesn't mean anything exotic, it just means the road, the path, the way. In Christianity, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. The metaphor of the way is arguably the most fundamental human spiritual intuition of being on a way, being on a path, heading somewhere, being able to move without impediment. Imagine you're walking in a forest. You're walking in the hills. When you're walking along and the path is open before you, you get into your stride. You find your second wind. You enjoy the sheer energy of movement, of the landscape opening up around and before you. There is life now pouring forth your body in your experience, and then you go round a corner and there is a great big tree across the path. Or if you're in the mountains, sometimes the path has literally slipped away from the mountainside. And then suddenly you have to stop. Something has got in the way. Something has prevented you from pursuing your path. And then, of course, everything really slows down. You have to negotiate this obstruction. You have to somehow get round it. Another task is involved, one that delays you. And it's the same in meditation. You are sitting here or walking, and there's this sometimes highly satisfying sense of movement, of flowing, of your life moving without hindrance, without impediment. And then you think of something that you want, or you think of something that you hate, or you start doubting yourself, or you start feeling very sluggish and drowsy and weary, especially when it's hot like this. Or you start getting really hyper, restless. The mind starts firing on all cylinders. But generally when that happens, you just start going round and round and round and round and round and round. And you lose touch with that sense of that inner flow. You get blocked. You get obstructed. These are why they are called hindrances. Hindrances are also very seductive. You know, live like a milk-sucking baby. In other words, they're like sort of nipples that appear to us. And we want to sort of go, ooh, yes, let's have a good draw on that one. And we see this in meditation too. Everything is flowing rather well. We're with the breath, we're with the body. And then this image appears, this very seductive image, and we hesitate for a moment. This is terribly interesting, we think. I'd like to go there. I'd like to follow that one. Maybe it's the first line of some great poem. Maybe it's the face of someone we love. Or whatever it is. But as it appears, we're faced with, as it were, a dilemma. Do we let that go? Do we just notice it for what it is? Or do we let it seduce us? Do we somehow buy into it and clutch onto it? And you may have noticed when you do that, or more often when it happens to you, you're no longer in that flow. You're no longer, in a way, pursuing your path, but you have been diverted, you've been distracted. And very often at the end of the meditation, there's a rather unpleasant feeling in your mouth, maybe, or in yourself. You feel as though you've somehow somehow lost it, somehow compromised yourself. There's an image that comes quite frequently in the Pali text. And I'm particularly referring here to a text called the Padana Sutta, or the Striving, which is in the Sutta Nipata, for those of you who are interested. In this text, you have the image of the Buddha seated on the bank of the river, the Nerañjara. This is before the awakening, so he's not really the Buddha yet. And he's sitting there intent on this practice. And then it says, Namuchi approached him. Namuchi approached me, uttering compassionate words. You're so thin, he said. You've got such a terrible complexion. You look as though you're going to die. Live, sir, live. It's so much better if you perform merits, practice the sacrifices. Why all of this struggle? So this is an example very much of these kind of, this is the voice of self-doubt, essentially. And I'm sure it happens to us all. But who is Namuchi? Why is Mara here called Namuchi? Namuchi is a figure from ancient Indian mythology, from Vedic mythology. Namuchi is the demon who prevents the monsoon rains from falling. Now, any of you who have been in India know that the very survival of the communities in India depends upon the rains, the monsoon. And if you've, I don't know if you've lived during the build-up to and then the monsoon, there's this rather awful period before the monsoon breaks when it gets terribly hot. The monsoon threatens to come, the clouds build up, there's thunder, there's lightning, but there's no rain. And in ancient India, they saw that as the work of this figure called Namuchi. Namuchi holds back the rain. And in fact, the word Namuchi literally means the one who stops the waters, the one who holds back the waters. And so the god Indra, the king of the gods, has to strike Namuchi with his vajra, with his scepter. And struck by Indra's scepter, Namuchi lets go of his grip and the rains fall. It's a very powerful image. And it's interesting that the early Buddhist community saw Mara as being like that, as that which prevents the flow of water. Now remember, water is the, and I think we're very aware of it nowadays in this country, water is the preeminent symbol of life. Without water we can't live. Plants cannot grow. The world cannot flourish. And Mara, Namuchi, is that which holds the waters back, which blocks the flow of life. So in this sense, if Mara is that which blocks the flow of life as a kind of death, then Buddha becomes a symbol or an image for the freely flowing life itself. And in this sense, in terms of this imagery, the Buddha is an example of someone who is living fully, who's living without the impediments that prevent us from really being what we potentially can be. It's the opposite to being stuck. It's the opposite to being somehow retentive, grasping, holding on. And again, this of course brings up another term that we find again and again in the Buddha's teaching, the idea of craving, the idea of grasping. Grasping is an inner tendency we have in which we tighten up. You can even feel it sometimes. It's as, and some, one of the images used is that of a knot, K-N-O-T. We feel knotted inside. We feel tied up. That the patterns of grasping, which of course are rooted in our obsession with ego, me, the centrality of me and the preserving of me, as opposed to others, our attachment to things, our grasping at what seems to give us pleasure, our desire to get rid of what seems to cause us pain, that whole psychological strategy of clinging is precisely what prevents us from being fully alive. And so the Buddha talks of dukkha, of suffering, as having its roots in this grasping, in this craving. And the practice of the path begins when that craving is released, when that grasping, either momentarily or for longer periods, stops. Or, as we'll see in a minute, how we can not succumb to the habit of grasping and clinging. There's a passage in the Digha Nikaya where the Buddha says, whenever a person grasps, Mara stands beside them. So Mara, or Namuchi, or death, inner death, is really, in psychological language, a deep inner grasping and holding on, a clutching, a shutting down. We'll look more at this tomorrow in the context of the four ennobling truths. Another way in which Mara is described is in the term Antaka. Mara, the Buddha sometimes calls Mara Antaka. Anta means limit or end or border. And ka implies an active agency. So Mara is the one who limits us, who keeps us within borders, who constrains us by a sense of our having a kind of end to ourselves. I kind of end here, the world starts there. We enclose ourselves in fixed identities, whether that be my psychological sense of me, or whether it be whatever other fixed identities that I'm attached to. Being a Buddhist, for example, that's one of my problems. I'm rather attached to this idea of being a Buddhist. Other of you may have other such religious or political or other identities that, for all that they provide, very often have a shadow side. They give you a sense of purpose, of meaning, but at the same time, any kind of view, any kind of position that you take is also going to have the darker aspect of closing you off, of differentiating you from the other. The Buddha calls this elsewhere our delight and pleasure in our place. We want to hold on to that place. This again is another way of talking about Mara, the Antaka, the limiter. We find ourselves in limits, and anything can become a limit. Nothing is exempt from becoming a condition of entrapment, another kind of snare or trap. Even the most noble things can also be traps. The human mind has an enormous capacity to make anything somehow demonic. That it's not a question really of either or. It's noticing that whatever situation we're in, whether internally or socially or politically or religiously, can both be a way that can lead us to greater life, but also it can become another form of death. And the crucial thing really is our relationship to these things. There's nothing wrong with being a self or a person or an identity. That's unavoidable. That's what we are, how we recognize ourselves, how we recognize others, how we can understand ourselves as an evolving, developing person. But it has the shadow side of another trap. I can become somehow overly preoccupied and obsessed by being me. So wherever we go, Mara is lying in wait. Mara is waiting there to grab us. There's also, we find here in this form of mythic language, like the passage I just quoted, the Buddha sitting by the river, and then Mara comes up to him and speaks to him. What does that mean? It suggests that these attachments, these cravings, these graspings operate as autonomous complexes in the psyche. That's the definition that Jung gave of neurosis. The problem with neurosis, or being neurotic, is that the worry, the anxiety, the craving, whatever it might be, is difficult to cope with because it seems to have a life of its own. You might have noticed this. You don't want to be worried or anxious about something. You find yourself being worried and anxious about something. Despite your noblest intentions, your deepest wishes, you're sitting here trying to be mindful and alert, and then suddenly you are in the grip of this anxiety or this thought that just won't go away. And the more you try to get rid of it, the stronger it gets, very often. It just, your resistance to it, your aversion to it, very often intensifies it, makes it into an even bigger problem. So there's something about grasping that is not in our control. It's something that happens to us. So we have to ask ourselves, in what way can we free ourselves from something over which we have no control? We'll come back to that. But that, I think, is an important point. We often think that if I just kind of will it away, I tell myself, don't worry, be happy. a very nice idea. It might provide a certain amount of ease, but it doesn't actually get to the root of the problem. The stuff keeps coming back. That Mara somehow invades us, comes in and gets us. Again, going back to this monk I mentioned before, Shantideva. When he describes the practice of mindfulness, he says that mindfulness, or recollection, is like the guardian at the doorway of the senses. The guardian at the doorway of the senses, totally alert to what's happening. But as soon as the guardian gets distracted, or the guardian goes off for a cup of tea, or the guardian falls asleep, or the guardian looks the other way, then, Shantideva says, the negative mind states, the kilesa, come rushing in. And we might have noticed this in meditation. We're nice and mindful, attentive, calm, and then for some reason we get distracted, or we doze off a bit, or we drift, and the next thing we know, we're caught up in rage, or lust, or guilt, or whatever it is. It's as though as soon as that alertness and mindfulness is lost, we're open to the invasive power of this kind of death. And sometimes many minutes can go by before you even register what's happened. And you're caught up in this turmoil of thought and emotion and so on. And it's very difficult once that has set in to do much about it. It's kind of too late. So the practice of mindfulness is also the practice of learning to notice more clearly, more precisely, the first stirrings of these kinds of invasive thoughts and feelings. And then Shantideva's advice is when, as soon as you notice these things, you remain like a piece of wood, you remain like a log. You just notice what's happening. You are fully aware of the stirring of this emotion or this train of thought, and rather than let it somehow hook you, another image the Buddha uses, and pull you away, you just notice it for what it is. You see it as a train of associative thoughts. You see it as an emotion, as a fear, as a desire, as a craving. You don't condemn it. There's nothing wrong with it in itself. It's just the play of the mind. It's just the play of the mind. So mindfulness and this whole practice achieves its freedom not by getting rid of these things. but by seeing them for what they are, by noticing them, by seeing how, for example, they are impermanent, that they're not going to remain as long. As soon as they've burnt out their charge, they'll stop, they'll dissipate. But it is, once we grab onto them, once we identify with them, I am angry, I'm really worried, that identification is like giving the fire more fuel. It's like pouring petrol, gasoline, onto a fire, and it flares up. So the kind of awareness we're speaking of here and we're seeking to cultivate in the meditation is an awareness that sees things more lucidly, more immediately, and simply sees them for what they are. Impermanent states of mind that, having arisen, will pass away. And in many of the dialogues between the Buddha and Mara, and this is an example of that here, if I can find it. I can't, never mind. In many of these dialogues, at the end of the dialogue, Mara says this, the Buddha says that. They sort of banter back and forth a bit. And then the Buddha says, I know you, Mara. Or sometimes Mara says, he knows me. and once that happens, it says, and then the guitar dropped from the arm of Mara, and the discouraged demon disappeared on the spot. So what we're doing here is not engaging in a battle that we have to somehow vanquish, destroy this anxiety, this desire, this craving, this hatred. As soon as we get into that kind of aggressive relationship, me versus Mara, we're not going to win. We're just going to actually intensify the whole problem. So Mara, or these destructive fantasies and thoughts and feelings, are not overcome by getting rid of them, but by knowing them for what they are, being able to look them in the face and say, I know you, I recognize you, I know what's going on here. And that is what disempowers these forces. There's a beautiful passage here where the Buddha says, the Buddha compares the forces of Mara to an army. And he says, I see your army all around me. You find that also, that same image in the book of Job. Yov? Yeah. That's a very good example of the whole Mara business. And in fact, it is Satan who gets God's permission to go and cause poor old Yov a lot of hassle. And the same imagery we find running through that text about paths being blocked off, of being encircled by an army. It's exactly the same. I see your army all around me. I see you on your elephant, which in those days was like a tank. I shall go forth in the battle. That army of yours, which the world together with the devas, the gods, cannot overcome, I shall break with wisdom as if I'm breaking an unfired pot with a stone. I will destroy your armies in the same way that I throw a stone and it breaks an unfired pot. You understand that? An unfired pot. A pot, a clay pot that has been made out of clay and is become hard, but it hasn't been put in the oven. It hasn't been fired. In other words, although it looks solid, it's not. That's the important point here. The great big pot in the corner looks like something that if you threw a stone at it, the stone would just go ping and bounce off. But once you realize that it's an unfired pot, all you have to do is lob a stone, it hits the pot and the thing just crumbles. Part of the power of Mara is that he presents himself, this is mythological language, he presents himself as something that's much stronger and more solid than it really is. We are tricked into thinking that anxiety or desire or fear or hatred are actually much powerful than they really are. They appear sometimes to be unbearable. They appear sometimes to be completely overwhelming. We feel completely submerged and overcome. But part of the reason we do is because we have invested them with too much power. We have somehow come to believe that these things are really much more powerful than they are. They're like an army. And then the Buddha says, in fact, they're not. They're very fragile states of mind that come and go. And all you need is to lob the stone of wisdom, in other words, to see these things more clearly for what they are. And all of that, those powerful forces disintegrate and break down. So the freedom we're speaking of is not involving the overcoming of some great powerful force, but rather learning to see that force for what it really is, the play of the mind, the play of the world, and learning to live with it more intelligently rather than feel that we have to overcome it. Sometimes people think that the practice of meditation is about emptying the mind. Well, try it if you like. But the chances are, unless you get into a very kind of deep absorption in which you're kind of, in a way, opting out of the situation, the mind will keep on generating thoughts and stuff. That's just what the human organism does. And we have to accept that. That's what we are. That's not a problem. The problem is because we exaggerate the power of some of these drives and fears and longings instead of seeing them as simply the impermanent ripples of the mind. What is also very striking about this literature concerning Mara is that although the Buddha is described as the one who has overcome Mara, who has conquered Mara. This is a very classical Buddhist iconographic image. You have the Buddha seated on the throne with his hand touching the earth, and surrounding him in a kind of halo are all of these demons with bows and arrows and spears and axes and so on. And the Buddha's just sitting there looking really cool. Nice little smile on his face. He's not bothered by it at all. And the much of traditional Buddhism understands that as the Buddha having quite literally got rid of all of the cravings and the greed, hatred, delusion, that these things, as the texts often say, have been cut off like a palm stump. Which is a very violent image, if you think about it. They've somehow been lobotomized, cut off, destroyed, never to arise again. But that whole way of thinking, which is probably the more orthodox view in Buddhism, that the Buddha has literally destroyed all these things within himself, is contradicted by all of these passages concerning Mara, in which, right to the end of the Buddha's life, Mara keeps appearing. So how can something that has been cut off like a palm stump keep coming back? In other words, Mara does not stop at the Buddha becoming awakened or enlightened. Mara keeps on being around. Mara constantly appears. after the Enlightenment, right up until shortly before the Buddha's death, you know, 2 or 3 months before he dies, there's the final encounter with Mara. Now this points very much to Mara, the demonic, all of this stuff, as not being something that you free yourself from by destroying it, but rather by entering into a radically new relationship with it, learning to live with the devil rather than to destroy the devil. And I think the implications of this are rather far-reaching, not just in our own psychological self-understanding, but also how we comport ourselves with conflicts within a community, for example. Do we achieve our goals by destroying things? Or do we achieve our goals by learning to live with the things that we find difficult to accept? It's a big human dilemma. But we have a beautiful image of this in this very same text. We have the Buddha and the Mara having their usual dialogue. And then Mara goes away from the Buddha and sits down. And he says to himself, I once remember a bird, a crow, circling a stone that looked like fat. And the bird was thinking, perhaps there's something soft here, something for me to eat. And so the bird dives down onto what it thinks of as a piece of fat, but as soon as it starts pecking at it, it cannot gain any effect. This beak just bounces off the stone. Tap, 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 tap. No food there. So not obtaining anything to eat, the bird flew away. Like a crow attacking a rock, I have attacked the Buddha and now I am despondent. And I'm too going to go away. Now here we have an image of freedom, an image of liberation, which is not involving any destruction of anything, but rather is about finding a way of mind, a way of being, in which you become impervious or immune to the attacks of Mara. In other words, your mind becomes a bit like that rock. Mara can fly in, but Mara can't get any purchase. There's no toehold. There's nowhere that Mara can hold on. And so Mara just flies away. Whereas when I'm meditating, it sometimes feels as though my mind is like a kind of landing strip for Mara. A kind of heliport. And the traffic controllers are saying, come in Mara, runway 2's free, runway 3's free. No problem, come in. Whereas the Buddha's mind is somehow like a rock, and whatever arises can't find any place to land. Now that's the real freedom. It doesn't mean that this Buddha has no longer any desires or fears or whatever, but rather these things are no longer able to gain any hold on him. Now, in our better meditations, we can probably see that for ourselves. When we achieve a degree of stillness, of mindfulness, of attention, we can see these feelings and stuff coming towards us, playing around, but we're able to simply be with them rather than to be of them. They don't gain any hold on us, and as such they drift away, fly away like the bird. So the Buddha's freedom, therefore, and this of course is also the sort of freedom that we're open to every moment, really. that every moment in our lives now, we have the possibility either to be like the Buddha, in other words, open and present to whatever is occurring without being agitated and anxious about things, but seeing things clearly or more clearly for what they are, or we can give in to our habits, our patterns, our fears, our desires, in which case they then take over. So one could perhaps even speak of there being a kind of Buddha nature within us, but also at the same time a Mara nature. And the two are the same. They're just different configurations of the same thing. There's no opposition here. An image which is a bit odd, but I find helpful, it's like a valve. A valve, you know, a valve when you have a bicycle and you want to pump it up. You pump through the valve. The valve allows the air to go through but not to get out. In other words, a valve can be open or a valve can be closed. And we too can be like an open valve, the Buddha, in which things just go through. Or we can be like a closed valve, Mara, in which things get stuck. Things can't get out. Things can't get in. So we need, I think, in this practice to go beyond oppositional thinking. Good versus bad. Buddha versus Mara. And to recognize that these are just two different configurations of the same thing. Like a valve. A valve can be open, a valve can be closed, but it's still the same valve. It doesn't become something else. There's not two things going on here. There's not Buddha and Mara. There's Buddha Mara. One or the other is a... They're talking about different possibilities, different capacities that are available in each moment. So don't think of the Buddha as something in the remote distance. Don't think of Mara as some horrible demon that's coming to get you. They're different. They're just different ways of being in the world. The Buddha way or the Mara way. And we have the freedom to be one or the other. At least that is how I would understand it. And here we have to stop. Thank you.